Well, welcome to the podcast, Are You Taking Care of Yourself? And I'm Dr. Michael Finkelstein. I have the pleasure of speaking today with Ian Newham, who has worked with me on a number of projects, specifically my book, 77 Questions for Skillful Living, and these podcast series. But Ian is here today as an expert. He happens to be a professor at the State University of New York College campus in Rockland, and he's the co-author of another book, The 30-Day Diabetes Miracle, and it's actually a series of books, and he's frequently a lecturer on that subject. But most important, as far as his expertise from my point of view and for this discussion today to help you see how you're going to take care of yourself differently, is that Ian also is a person with type 1 diabetes himself. The subject comes to our mind every year around now, because November is American Diabetes Month. The National Diabetic Association, American Diabetic Association, sort of picks this time for us to sort of reflect on the condition we call diabetes. And I have to say, maybe it's not an accident, Ian, that they choose November, which is the month that includes Thanksgiving and the beginning of this holiday season, where we are drawn to food consumption like at no other time of the year. And you know as well as I do that so much about diabetes is reflected in where we're heading as a culture, a society, in terms of the food we eat, the way we live our lives. And while science has had many advances with regard to improvements in medications and even understanding from a physiological point of view, the big picture here is we're living a certain way and that lifestyle is affecting our health, and diabetes is the poster child for that situation. So Ian, welcome to Are You Taking Care of Yourself, the podcast.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to be here. It's nice to be on this side of the mic. How are you today?
I happen to be great, and I'm feeling pretty good. I had a nice restful time, a couple of days celebrating with my partner away, and so and it makes me think about the times that we need to take care of ourselves. You know, like once in a while, we just need to get away. So that's how I feel. I feel well relaxed and ready to get myself back into this flow. But let me ask you that question. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I think I'm really pleased to be talking about diabetes. It's been a really important subject to talk about in my life, and I'm really interested in talking to the audience today about this. And I want to frame this as kind of good news and bad news. And I'm a very optimistic person, so normally I would give the good news first, and I want to say that there is lots of good news about diabetes. But I want to sort of spin this around first and kind of give some bad news first. We know already that diabetes is a tsunami, a tidal wave, an absolute catastrophe that's facing us. The American Diabetes Association, which you just talked about, has absolutely tried everything in their storehouse to try to solve this problem. But essentially, they're really not minding the store properly. We know that they're well-meaning. We know that they've thrown good money after bad here. But we know that they're not doing all they can do, or they're certainly not doing the right job. The CDC estimated that in the year 2000, 1 in 3 children born that year will develop diabetes sometime in their lifetime. 1 in 2 children among certain populations. That can't be right, and that's certainly not right. We know that we don't need that kind of statistic. We can just walk over to the Walmart on any given Sunday, and we could see that people are not taking care of themselves. But this is not a disease of genetics. This is a disease of choice, type 2 diabetes. It's a disease of our culture. We've gotten into a kind of groove, haven't we? And the difference between a groove and a grave is only a tiny matter of degree.
Yeah.
And you're a doctor, I'm a patient, and an educator. I could say that this isn't right. I would say that not one more person should get this disease. Not one more child in the city or the country should get this disease. But there is a lot of hope. We want to say today to everybody out there that if you take care of yourself, there is absolutely no reason you should get this disease of choice, type 2 diabetes. And if, like me, you should, through no fault of your own, get a disease like type 1 diabetes, there's no reason that you should show any signs of that disease, that with good, proper self-care and good treatment from a good lifestyle doctor, like Dr. Finkelstein, that there's no reason that you should show any signs of disease or have any expectation that you'll die early or get any sort of ravages. Do you agree with that, Dr. Finkelstein?
Well, I mean, I couldn't agree more. The fact of the matter is that it's, as I said in the introduction, diabetes is the poster child for what's ailing us as a society. And we see the numbers increasing in alarming trends, but most concerning to me is how young people are now when they're getting type 2 diabetes. And this is a condition, if you will, from a physiological point of view, that really reflects excess bombardment of the body's cells with calories, sugar, and an absence of the balance in terms of the nutrients as well as the activity and the whole lifestyle that, you know, we're designed to actually achieve naturally. So this is just, it's upsetting. And what's most upsetting to me as a physician trained in a very good place is that the focus of physicians for the most part is, let's get that glucose level down by any means possible, at least that I can write a prescription for. And the discussion about how one takes care of themselves is really off the table. It's not in that office. It's left for people to figure it out on their own. And even though there's a lot more conversations about it, the resources are not readily available. And that's why I want to talk to you about this. I agree. We need to have a conversation. As a society, collectively, we need to have more of a conversation, not just about making healthcare available, like insulin available and oral hypoglycemics available. Sure, I mean, that makes sense. But what about helping people not get there to begin with, or, as you said, even if they were to be, you know, sort of unlucky in the sense, nobody really necessarily understands how type 1 diabetes occurs in children, but perhaps just a certain type of bad luck with immune system and viruses and who knows what, maybe some genetics there. But there's still ways of dealing with it so that it doesn't really have to affect your life the way it does when people are completely uncared for, untreated.
Right. Let me start a little bit with some good news for once about diabetes. A few things on my list here. Number one, diabetes is not a death sentence. So a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, or even type 1 diabetes, does not mean you're going to have to die earlier than your peers. It doesn't mean, you know, even though, you know, the risk for people with diabetes is about twice, you know, as that of people without diabetes, you know, of a similar age, sort of dying young, the reason for that is because people tend not to take care of themselves once they're diagnosed with that. If you make the right choices about your lifestyle, that will not happen to you. Number two, having diabetes doesn't mean that you're going to get awful complications from diabetes. Or people associate diabetes with eventually going blind or requiring dialysis or getting the trauma of amputations. They have this horrible term for that called salami surgeries, meaning first they take your toe and then they go up to the ankle and then they take your leg. We've seen, you know, your aunt, your uncle, your grandmother go through that. And the reason for that is not so much because the disease is doing that to you. It's because the choices you're making about how you're taking care of yourself is doing that to you. That's not going to happen to me. There's no reason physically, physiologically, that's going to happen to me because I'm taking care of myself. Diabetes, number three, is not primarily a genetic disease. There's that old expression that genetics might load the gun, but what's going to pull the trigger there is the choices that I'm going to make, the decisions that I'm going to make. I'm not going to pull that trigger as long as I'm taking care of myself.
And that really is a key point, Ian. I mean, I think that, you know, people hesitate to go to doctors to begin with because they don't want to hear the bad news.
Right.
But and that's really understandable. I mean, it's frightening to some extent. But what you're saying is, yes, this is serious. However, there are ways we can respond as individuals, and it makes such a difference. And therefore, imagine if you don't have diabetes and you respond this way, meaning you just take care of yourself.
Right.
That would be my message to everyone, whether you have it or not. And then you don't wind up with diabetes, so that you're using the same advice that we might start to talk about and prevent a condition, not just like diabetes, but everything else. The fact of the matter is this lifestyle medicine that you're talking about is the type of approach that solves a lot of problems, prevents a lot of problems. So, and again, diabetes is just the perfect example of how well it responds to better care.
That's right, because you don't get this disease like you get the flu. Well, you know, maybe that's a bad example, because we're arguing that, we're making an argument about the flu too, but, you know, there about 1.5 or 2 million people a year get diabetes, but you don't get it. You get it through the foods you eat. You get it through the lifestyle choice that you make. It's totally within your control, and, you know, good lifestyle choices can prevent this. And it doesn't mean that you're going to have to take large doses of medicine. You know, even if you have type 1 diabetes, it doesn't mean that you're going to have to take large doses of medicine. Now, I have type 1 diabetes. The beta cell function in my pancreas is at a zero. It means my pancreas is not creating any insulin at all. So I have to take insulin through a pump that is connected on the outside of my body, but that insulin production is actually lower than the average person's pancreas is producing, because I'm making the right choices about how I do physical activity and what kinds of foods I eat. So I'm actually technically healthier than the average person in America, because I'm making some good lifestyle choices. So there
well,
are people.
And that's how a condition just in general is another perspective shift that people can have is sometimes diseases can be, you know, could present a silver lining that as a result of what you have to deal with, and as it may be in some aspects, and again, not to diminish the angst, the pain, sometimes the suffering that's associated with diseases, but if one rises above it, really gets the message, starts taking care of themselves, then what used to be taken for granted as I'm just going to be fine, I don't have to think about it, and I don't really care if I meet with my friends tomorrow or spend a night this week with my children, you don't take those things for granted anymore. You see all of that as being precious examples of and the reasons for living, and a disease can wake you up, and it can make you mindful and conscious. You know, I think that, you know, as I've known you now for many years, your level of consciousness your choices and your clarity is remarkable. You look and you are a healthy person because of how you're behaving, not because of what your genes are, not because of what your doctor tells you. It's because of how you are in the world, and you can look at yourself in the mirror and you know it.
Absolutely true. And, you know, sometimes it's a daily struggle, and I'm not out there, you know, lecturing people or talking to people or holding myself up as some sort of, you know, expert who's done things perfectly. But I can tell you that things used to be awful, and what I had was a kind of hopelessness. I'm 44 now, and I'm healthier now than I ever was before, and it's because of a kind of wake-up call here. I am so grateful for this disease, and that sounds really preposterous. But, you know, in 2004, when things had gotten really bad, I'd gained 35 pounds. I was eating like a guy going to the electric chair. And mm-hmm. for me, food was a kind of, I don't know, I guess like a convenient consolation prize for what I felt like was sort of hard luck in the health department. I was diagnosed with a very rare and complicated cancer at age 27. I had very bad back and joints. I mean, very bad back. I had surgeries. I had crippling, almost daily migraine headaches. I had chronic sinus infections. I had Lyme disease. I had very awful allergies to boot. This probably sounds like a lot of people in your audience. And everything was connected, but I didn't realize that. So I would go and treat individual symptoms of things. And then along came, a bummer pancreas, which went. And I'd had more than a dozen surgeries by the age of 30. And all these things seemed disconnected. And I was having, you know, one surgery after another, and one was less pleasant than the last. I mean, imagine how much fun a radical neck dissection can be. Mm-hmm. And for years, I was either locked for days on end in, like, lead rooms for massive radioactive iodine ablation treatments, or I was hooked up to intravenous treatments or antibiotics, or I was connected for a period of time to this thing called an electric stimulator, which was literally wired into my spine to jolt my limbs to help me walk, which I did kind of like Frankenstein's monster. And when I first got diabetes, I was prescribed this huge dose of insulin, I mean a massive dose of insulin, and this was the typical treatment for diabetes. I was given like a 30-second demonstration on how to shoot myself up with insulin and basically told, here's how to quote-unquote cover your blood sugar, because the treatment by the American Diabetes Association, well-meaning as it is, and most doctors is, keep your blood sugar low. This essentially means go ahead and eat a couple of boxes of Girl Scout cookies if you must, or some Dunkin' Donuts or McDonald's, and keep your blood sugar low. This means chase blood sugar with insulin. So as long as you put your doctor and say, look, here's my blood sugar, it's at 80. Now, I might have done this by taking 80, you know, units of insulin, but my blood sugar is low. And what you fail to learn from this lesson is that insulin is not good for you either if it's taken in massive doses. Insulin is a growth hormone. It stimulates the growth of fat, among other things, and that's kind of an oversimplification. But too much insulin can be as bad for you as too much sugar in your blood. Both of these things are bad. One is bad for tiny blood vessels, and one is bad for big blood vessels. I mean, that's the short story there. It's not good for you. It's not natural. Any more insulin in your system than the body would ordinarily produce, and that's in the neighborhood for an adult male of in between, let's say, 20 and 25 units, is too much. And there are people in this country walking around Walmart, you see them every day, who are prescribed 100, 150, sometimes 200 units of insulin a day. Right. That's really, really, truly, truly awful for you. And all they're doing is chasing that blood sugar with too much insulin. But when they go to their doctor, and the doctor might be well-meaning, but because of insurance company interference and all kinds of other problems, and the mere 7 minutes they have to deal with their patient, they just look at that bottom line blood sugar and they say, okay, the blood sugar looks okay. So they give their patient a pass, but the patient is really getting a terrible message there. They're not really taking care of themselves by eating right in the first place. They're chasing blood sugar with insulin. So I got that lesson. When I got the wake-up call, and the wake-up call is the message that I got from you and other lifestyle medicine doctors, primarily two great, great doctors I worked with at a place called the Lifestyle Center of America in Oklahoma, a doctor named Franklin House and a doctor named Stuart Seal, doctors with whom I wrote the book, The 30-Day Diabetes Miracle, they taught me a lesson about taking care of myself. It's very similar to the message that you continue to teach me. That was a lesson about eating right in the first place, which we'll talk about in a future podcast. That lesson really has gotten me to the point where I went from that, you know, eating ice cream on the couch and taking large doses of insulin to really being healthier than I've ever been before. I mean, having climbed Kilimanjaro and now, you know, being a volunteer firefighter and, you know, being healthier than I've ever been before and being in a position now to help other people get there. But one small step at a time. And you don't have to climb Kilimanjaro. And you don't have to run into burning buildings to do this. I think you have to find your own Kilimanjaro. That is, you know, what is it for you that's going to make your life worth living to get you off that couch? It could be as simple as wanting to pick up your grandkids, or it could be as simple as, you know, wanting to wake up and feel good about yourself. That simple purpose in your life, that's enough.
Well, that's, Ian, what a story first. You know, but I think what you said it along the way, I mean, you seem to have had everything thrown at you. But I imagine people who are listening to this will have similar conundrums where, you know, there's just one thing, then another, then a third. And as I saw it when I was practicing medicine, you know, I would send people like that to 3, 4, 5 different specialists to deal with each of the body parts. And they would get good advice, but there would be very little connecting those dots. And nobody was really looking for any unifying, you know, situation, I mean, or unifying opportunity for, dare I say, use the word cure. And I don't mean cure in the way that, you know, sort of snake oil salesmen are throwing things at you. I'm just saying there are common denominators to these sorts of things, and you found it. which is how you take care of yourself. And when one can't say that they take care of themselves as well as they could, or even reasonably well, or they don't even know where to begin on with regard to that, that surely is a setup for these things to continue. And even with the best of Western medicine, we see what happens. And people just wake up in the morning not feeling well either. So that, forget about the long term, the short term is really affected. So, you know, I think this is a perfect spot to pause, because as you know, we have the idea to break this subject into three, and that this is the first of the three podcasts on the subject of diabetes. We might call it the good news for once, because there is good news here. And if you all stay with us and tune in to the next podcast, we're going to talk more about how to take care of yourself specifically the notion of the lifestyle cure that we allude to here numerous times. So stay with us. Ian, thank you again for joining me. It's a pleasure and an honor to work with you. Your story makes it all more evident that you're a special person. And so I think our audience is in for a treat. Stay with us, everyone. Well, welcome again to the podcast, Are You Taking Care of Yourself? I'm Dr. Michael Finkelstein. I'm the author of 77 Questions for Skillful Living. And what I am going to be talking about today with my guest, Ian Newham, is living skillfully with diabetes. As I mentioned in the first of this series of three podcasts on the subject of diabetes, Ian is a professor at SUNY Rockland College and the co-author of the 30-Day Diabetes Miracle series of books. He frequently lectures on the subject and is a person with type 1 diabetes himself, which of course makes him particularly informed and invested in terms of this whole subject. And as we talked about in the last podcast, this is largely a disease of lifestyle and lifestyle gone awry. And Ian, welcome back first.
Thank you, sir. Let me be here.
And secondly, let's before we get into the subject of, let's say, this podcast, which is about how to take care of yourself and the idea of curing the lifestyle or the lifestyle that can cure you, let's talk about the history and how we got to this place. I know you have a lot to say on that subject.
I do. I love this question. There's a couple of interesting things about this question. One of them is something that anthropologists call cattle creep. And what this really has to do with is our culture of abundance. And so what I kind of mean by this is a kind of historical sea change, kind of geographical paradox. Essentially what that means is nowadays the kind of stuff we're eating are things that in the old days only the kings would eat. Mm-hmm. So we have all kinds of processed food and all kinds of rich people stuff, you know, expensive meats and gourmet stuff and all kinds of processed stuff that in the old days only the very, very rich could get. So we got better and better and better at producing and later processing food so we could grind wheat into flour to make bread, for example. And we have a culture of abundance now that only came from having organized together in favor of the comforts of brute protection. So we were able to get agriculture. We were able to get the domestication of animals. A dramatic change in lifestyle that essentially gave us modern civilization. So villages and economies and trade and new technology and sophistication and cultural hierarchy, all that stuff that we love that gave us all kinds of wonderful stuff, it created an abundance of food. All of that's great. We got short-term survival of our species, of course, but we also got some problems. If you think about it, we used to have famine all the time, and we are hardwired, and you're a doctor, I'm not, we're hardwired for famine, aren't we? We would have to hunt for, let's say, a bison, and it might take 3 days to chase this thing down. We'd burn a lot of calories doing it, and when we got it, we'd feast on that thing. We'd taken all this concentration of calories, and we're hardwired to store that stuff, fat and protein and calories, because it might be a long time before we get more meat, before we get more fat, before we get more calories. And if we were really, really lucky, we'd get one in a couple more days or a couple more weeks. But if we didn't, we'd store that stuff for later. Nowadays, it's all feast, isn't it? And almost no famine. Now we can go to McDonald's and get that concentration of fat and calories in a shake or a Big Mac, and there's no famine. But we're still hardwired. Our bodies still think that there might be a coming famine. So we're still hardwired to store that stuff for later, but there is no later, right? Because we have
what you're saying is going to be interesting to everyone who's ever wanted to lose some weight. And it's in their own experience, which is the proof of what you're saying. We all know how easy it is to gain weight. We eat, you know, 1 week's worth of good meals, you know, Thanksgiving and the leftovers, and we know how many pounds we gain. And if we try to sort of undereat a little bit the following week, there's no way we will lose all that weight, that our body more naturally assimilates the nutrients and stores it than it does let go of it, because we evolved just like every other animal on the planet with no guarantees that there's food tomorrow and that we have to hunt and forage for a living, and that, you know, there's things like weather out there and competition that make that challenging, and therefore we have to learn, you know, we have to have, and we do have the natural physiological mechanisms to retain, and we don't really lose weight very easily. So when we then, as you described, move culturally toward storage and abundance and all the stuff we associate with advancement, interestingly enough, the evolutionary process of our physiology has not kept up with that, and of course it won't keep up with that. It's not something that will feel the pressure of survival, quite the opposite. So, but we're getting sick because we just don't have the mechanisms to deal with that amount of abundance. And so your story is interesting, and I think interesting for everyone, whether you have diabetes or not.
Right, and think about, you know, how many calories you burn right now with your one little finger punching keys on a microwave to heat your food, as opposed to hunting for your food, or
right.
Even gardening for your food, which at least gets you walking and moving and planting and growing.
The incidental activity of life of the past doesn't generally exist for the average person any longer. And so this is, again, a subject about balance and imbalance. And so you're right. We live with all these conveniences, and these conveniences, to a large extent, are really bad for our health. And so it takes mindful awareness, dedicated attention to do something different than to just go down this polluted river into, you know, sort of ultimate stagnation and excess.
That's right. The calories it takes to use one finger to, you know, lower your electric window in your car as you pull up to the drive-thru window
right.
is not the same as hunting for your
Everywhere
food.
We look, it's easier for us to do with, you know, less and to consume more. And, you know, we didn't even get into the food specifically, but the types of foods that are now being produced, marketed, genetically modified for our benefit and consumption,
right.
for the ease of, you know, bringing them to market, are these storage foods, you know, these, you know, carbohydrate-like foods, and I use carbohydrate-like because they don't resemble really their original vegetable any longer. Just think of pasta. It's technically a vegetarian food, but it's nothing like the grass and the wheat that it's harvested from.
Right.
And so we have a dilemma here. So, Ian, so keep going. I sort of like where you're heading, but I think
because
you know, these illustrations help people see what's going on. And that was the question. How do we get here?
Right. Well, I've got a couple of sort of edible antidotes to diabetes. So diabetes is really sort of terribly ravaging our nation and our world. It's causing sort of untold economic and awful damage to our, you know, our nation, our world, our families, our bodies. There are antidotes to this, and they're edible. We can eat them. And I want to suggest one right off the bat that has worked for me, you know, wonders, and it's worked for millions of people. It's worked over eons, and it's working for a lot of people today. So here's my first suggestion to people out there. It's called breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, and supper like a pauper. So I want you to consider this. Imagine if you were to consume the bulk of your calories at the beginning of the day before you're about to expend all your energy, and a little bit less in the middle of the day and very little at the end of the day before you're about to go to bed. It's kind of like, imagine if you're about to fly on a trip, let's say you're going from New York to San Francisco, the pilot, you would really want to gas up the plane before you're about to fly, wouldn't you? Before you're about to drive on a journey, you want to gas up your car beforehand as opposed to at the end. So a lot of people eat their big meal at the end of the day. It's our tradition in our culture to do that. But it doesn't make much sense, does it? Because you need your energy at the beginning of your day before you're about to do the bulk of your stuff, as opposed to at the end of the day, closer to when you're about to go to sleep, and that's when you're going to store your energy. At the beginning of the day, when you're about to have your meal, what is that meal called? It's called breakfast, which means breaking the fast. Now, if you don't have a fast to break, you don't need to eat breakfast, right? This makes a lot of sense. So breakfast, your grandma used to tell you to take care of yourself as the most important meal of the day. That's true. You can afford to eat a big breakfast because you need to eat the bulk of your meal at the beginning of the day. Now, it doesn't mean that it should be a junky meal, like full of Pop-Tarts and junk. So eat a good, wholesome, this means good whole grains. Oatmeal is my favorite breakfast because it's a low glycemic meal. It means that you have a nice, slow, steady climb, especially if you have diabetes. It means it doesn't spike quickly and then drop fast where you're tired later. A good above-the-ground fruit, like, for example, a grapefruit is a good one. I like that. Berries are good, and maybe some whole grain toast. So I like an English muffin or something like that. Lunch like a prince means in the middle of the day you can still afford to have some good calories, but at the end of the day, don't have a giant meal. Eat something light, so maybe some soup or a salad or something like that, or a combination of those. But having a giant meal at 9 o'clock at night is not a good idea. So this is a really good idea for either to stave off diabetes, or if you have diabetes, to try to keep your blood sugars well under control. It's a nice, good, scientifically proven diet, and it also has the benefit of support from the wisdom of the ages.
I think you're onto something, which is, you know, how would we have eaten if we were living, you know, long time ago, let's say before refrigeration, before the type of storage that we have? How would we be moving around? How active would we be? When would we be working? When would we be resting? These are not hard for people to imagine, although I think they may need to really sort of think back towards history and keep going back further before maybe even written history to get a sense of what we're really physically constructed to do and how are we physically, you know, set up to thrive or not. And that's why I think that this perspective that you're sharing is really useful, because even though I think the dietary recommendations, you know, and if you ask, you know, five people, you probably get five different opinions on that, can vary, the principles are the same. We have to get back into balance. In general, we have to eat less, and in general, we have to eat more wisely, meaning more foods that are whole whenever we eat them. And, you know, combined with your advice, I think my only suggestions on top of everything that people have been listening to is think of whole foods. I still think whole foods are better than any processed food, including the healthier grains, only because I think our metabolism is more naturally able to digest it as that form. And in terms of the way foods are glycemic or not, meaning how much sugar they release and how quickly, the more broken down they are before we consume them, the more rapidly it's going to be absorbed compared to the whole food that preceded it. So, again, this is just about restoring balance. And so I like the perspective of just going back to how it used to be, not because I don't want to, you know, I want to unplug my refrigerator and I want to only walk. No, I like some of the conveniences, but I think we still have to combat the culture of abundance and growing abundance with common sense.
Absolutely. I like the mod cons too. But for diabetes, you got two really important things. I like the idea of, there's three important things I would say. Everyone agrees to eat, you know, keep your blood sugar levels in a low, healthy range and as tightly controlled as you can. The American Diabetes Association, the American Dietetic Association, everyone agrees with that, your doctor, your grandma. If you keep your blood sugars that are pretty much as tightly controlled as you can, this is the bad blood sugars are responsible for those gruesome long-term complications of diabetes, the things that everyone worries about, destruction of your eyes, kidneys, nerves. But the good side of that is the opposite's true. If you maintain tight blood sugar control and you keep your insulin down, you can delay and avoid, and in some cases even reverse. Let me repeat that. You can reverse devastating complications of diabetes. I know this has been true in my own life, and doctors were shocked when I first started taking care of myself and proved that lifestyle medicine works. If you also keep your overall fat and calories down, and if you eat about the same amounts and the same general types of food at each meal and about the same time every day, you can really reverse, prevent, if you don't have it already, but reverse the diabetes process. You can come off medicine. I've personally seen hundreds of people literally get out of wheelchairs, get off their insulin, do all that, and it sounds like a miracle, but it's true. Now, here's the good news. There is a diet that actually covers all these bases. It's not even close, by the way, to the diet recommended by the American Diabetes Association or the American Dietetic Association. That's probably one reason that diabetes in the United States is not getting better. It's getting significantly worse, and it has nothing at all to do with the standard American diet, which, by the way, the acronym for that is SAD. And this diet is a plant-based diet. It's another word for a vegetarian diet, but the plant-based diet is a diet that that has everything you need in it, and it has a lot of protective health factors. Dr. Finkelstein talks about how anti-inflammatory it is, and that's really his framework for it, and it's a really interesting framework for it. You can see a number of podcasts and a number of blogs about it here on Michael's website, or youtakingcareofyourself.com. But there is a lot about it to talk about, but one of the most important things about it is that it is full of fiber. A plant-based diet has more dietary fiber than does an animal-based diet. There is a huge amount of fiber in a plant-based diet, and that fiber lowers the risk for diabetes, and it significantly reduces the risk for heart disease and strokes and appendicitis and even some cancers. Fiber is our friend.
Mm-hmm.
Fiber can help patients with diabetes reduce their insulin intake. I know it's worked dramatically for me. The higher the fiber, the lower my insulin. And this is even true even if you eat a lot of fruit. People with diabetes think that they can't eat fruits. My diet is full of fruit. Even some fruit, and you have to be careful with this, and you have to experiment with which fruits work for you best. Every individual body is different. But a lot of people just think fruits are just right off the bat bad. Fiber does not contribute to raising blood glucose levels. So that means that people with diabetes can eat something high in fiber and not have to worry about it raising their blood sugar, as much as if they eat the same food without the fiber. So, for example, an orange will not raise your blood sugar the same as orange juice will raise your blood sugar. So, fiber is one of the three main types of carbohydrates in the diet. The other two are starches and sugars. But our bodies don't have the enzyme to free the glucose molecules from fiber. So we can absorb the glucose. This is why you can remove the fiber when you're looking at the nutrition label on some food. You can subtract out the fiber. This is what's known as net carbs. So the more the fiber you see on the label, essentially the better it's going to be for you as someone with diabetes. You can look at that net carb. It's essentially just a better food for you. And this is what Michael means by whole grains. Whole grains tend to have a lot more fiber in it. The more processed it is, the less fiber in it. It looks whiter instead of darker. So
let me interject a visual that I often use when I talk to my patients, because I think it's useful. But use the concept of an orange and orange juice. I like apples and apple juice, and the reason is people can understand what it might take to crush an apple in your hand. In fact, you can't. I mean, you have to be super powerful to do that. It's the fiber that prevents you from crushing the apple. It's the skeletal structure, if you will, of a vegetable. But, of course, you could sort of put it through a food processor of some sort and break down all that fiber and just release all the carbs, the glucose and the sugars and everything else that's in there. And that's why an apple and a juice made from the juice of one apple has the same amount of calories. But the fiber content is obviously the ingredient that's missing from the juice. The issue is, though, in going back in time, when apples were growing on the trees, you know, how many apples could you really eat at one time? Maybe two or three before you felt so full. Because, again, the fiber, you know, you can chew a certain amount of it, but it really does, you know, take a lot more than that. And it you know, occupies a lot more space in your stomach. Whereas how much apple juice could you drink if you wanted to? I mean, probably a gallon if you felt like it. An endless number of apples, which you could never consume in the wild. So nature protects us from doing crazy things. We've got these electronics now and these devices and this technology that we talked about before, which has improved, quote-unquote, the quality of our life and simplified things and given us more options, but it's in those options that we're making ourselves sick. And so,
that's right.
You know, this is why lifestyle is such an important subject when it comes to diabetes in particular, but most diseases, because if you can think of a lifestyle solution, then you're really just taking advantage of how you're already wired and how you're already made. It works so nicely. The trick for us, though, Ian, and I think is something that we'll, I think, need to talk about in the next podcast is what's on your mind, and our minds prevent a lot of this from being that easy. You know, you and I are making a lot of sense. I know most people are nodding their head, yes, yes, yes. But when it comes down to practically doing it, that's where I think we realize that there's something else going on. It's not just intelligence and it's not just information. There's something blocking us from actually executing a better lifestyle plan. So if you're with me, Ian, on that, we can take a break here, and then we can get back to podcast number 3 in the series, and hopefully our listeners will carry over. How's that sound to you?
I definitely want to do that, but I do want to just spend 20 more seconds saying one more thing.
Go ahead.
I don't want to finish quite yet, because I do want to say there's more about that plant-based lifestyle. It is lower in fat. It has no cholesterol. It has phytochemicals. It has antioxidants. It has all the protein you absolutely need. So I would strongly recommend this. And remember, there is no dietary fiber in meat. It all comes from plant-based lifestyle. But I agree wholeheartedly that diabetes really happens in the mind. So we'll join you in the next podcast. I thank you so much for this time, Dr. Finkelstein. I really appreciate it.
Ian, it's great. Always great to share this type of stuff with you. And stay with us, for all of you out there who are interested in taking care of yourself, because that's what we're going to be talking about. AreYouTakingCareOfYourself.com. Stay with us. Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Finkelstein, and I'm speaking with Ian Newham, who's a collaborator on my book, 77 Questions for Skillful Living, and also the author of a book, co-author of the book, 30-Day Diabetes Miracle. It's actually a series of books, and since Ian has type 1 diabetes himself, he has been forced to face what many of us sort of worry about or are experiencing when you look at the numbers. And that is the condition that we call diabetes. And as we talked about in the first two podcasts in the series, this is the third podcast, is that there is some good news. And part of that news is that there are ways you can take care of yourself that will make a real difference. But we got to, Ian, you know, in our conversation last, when we were talking about sort of the dietary approach, the common sense, the understanding of situations like how we consume fiber and where we came from in terms of this culture of abundance. But in my practice of medicine, you know, I see more and more people who are well-educated. I mean, not because they go through school, but because they have access to information on the Internet or through other people around them who have access to the Internet. And they're pretty well-informed. They know better. They may have challenges getting access to certain types of food we talked about, meaning the whole plant-based foods. I sort of hear that often. I don't know. I completely understand why people can't eat more grains and farmers market to advance their diet in the right direction. I think people have more information, more intelligence, well, the question that is what's on our minds, behavior. That's what we can talk about right now.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yep. Out that whole time. Michael?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. We got to start this one again. You were coming in and out that whole time, so I think it probably didn't record properly.
Okay, so I'm going to end this and we'll start again.
Yeah, let's both call in case.
Okay. Bye.
Okay.